Hello, welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in with me, the first part of the program, I have Daniel McGlynn. He's a USU ecologist, and he's been working on a project and a recently published article in the journal Nature about how plants survive the winter and how they've adapted to that. And I hope you'll join our conversation today. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your comment there. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I really, when I saw this last week, it was published in Utah State Today talking about the Nature article. I thought, I've got to have you on because this is really fascinating to me. I interviewed Dan Drost, the USU Extension vegetable specialist, last year about why plants like tomatoes not survive the cold, but yet my cruciferous vegetables like my broccoli and cabbage, they withstand it quite a bit. So that's why I wanted to look at this. So why don't we back up and describe what Earth was like 150 million years ago?
Sure. So 150 million years ago is really interesting in terms of plants because that's when we think the first flowering plants appeared on the scene. They first evolved. And so these are plants that actually produce a flower with pollen that are insect pollinated. And that early time in Earth's history was relatively warm and very moist. And so these early plants in this really moist climate tended to be a woody plant, and they also tended to grow very tall, have large, basically, vessels that conduct a lot of water very rapidly, and they also tended to be evergreen. So that means that they kept their leaves all year round. And so from this early evolutionary state, we now know that flowering plants have a really wide diversity of structures. Some plants drop their leaves. They have different vascular systems. And so what we were interested in this study was understanding how some of this diversity evolved in flowering plants. And in particular, we were really interested in how freezing poses a really strong evolutionary stress and how that might be responsible for some of the patterns we see in plants today.
So how were these plants reproducing 150 million years ago?
So primarily, most of the plant life was what we would refer to as a conifer or coniferous. So conifers are things like your Christmas tree. They produce small cones. They do release pollen, but they don't have the same flowering structure that, and they don't use insects. That's the really key thing. They were primarily wind pollinated. The usage of insects was really key because this allows plants to ensure that their pollen is carried to other individuals and increases genetic diversity in the population. This ability to have greater genetic diversity in your population is really important if you're going to adapt very rapidly. And so that's one of the reasons this novel evolutionary concept of the flower that really allowed these plants to become very diverse and very successful. They now inhabit all parts, you know, all habitats of the earth, and they're the most diverse group of plants.
And you don't see, like ferns or another one that are not part of that group that they're still around, but
sure. There
certainly seem to be a lot more flowering plants than there are the other ones.
Exactly. And ferns are a great example. You know, they're releasing spores into the environment. And so, again, that's a wind-dispersed thing, wind kind of pollinated thing. And so, yes, you know, they definitely were the dominant plants in the Cretaceous period. But once these flowering plants started to evolve, they really became major players in plant diversity relatively rapidly.
So there are different ways that your study has discovered that the plants adapted. So why don't you talk about those different adaptations?
Sure. So we really investigated three key adaptations with respect to climate that have been thought to be important for a long time. One of these is the fact that some flowering plants can drop their leaves, or in other words, they can be deciduous. So if you look outside right now here in Utah, you can see a lot of our trees have lost their leaves. And this, we thought early on, would probably be an adaptation to freezing tolerance. Another adaptation that I've already alluded to is the size of the vessels, or the chamber, you know, basically the conduits of water in the plants. And if you have a really large conduit, that's relatively sensitive to freezing. And so,
why is that?
The potential problem with freezing in large conduits is that you can get pockets of air in the conduit, and then that pocket of air can travel up and basically essentially block that pipe from being able to transfer water. So if you get enough pockets of air in your vascular system for these plants, they basically become drought stressed, essentially.
So this is what happens in your Christmas tree if you don't cut off the end and stick it right into the water. If the water gets down below the bottom, the air gets up into that system and basically keeps the tree from taking up the water.
Yeah, and a similar thing, you know, when the first cold weather in your garden hits and the plants look completely wilted, that's really actually a response to losing its water primarily. And then, you know, if you get a nice warm day and some of these plants, like you mentioned, the crucifers are relatively tolerant, they'll perk back up if it warms up and that kind of thing. So that's both drought and cold kind of have this similar pathway to stressing the plant, because they're basically causing that vascular system to cease to function. And so that was one of the adaptations we're really interested in. The last one was whether or not you are a woody plant or an herbaceous plant. So as I mentioned, we think that these early Cretaceous plants were primarily woody, but now we see a lot of flowering plants that are herbs, like tulips. Most of your garden plants, for example, are herbaceous. Basil is a great example that I love. And this herbaceousness is basically a great adaptation if it's going to get extremely cold outside. So you can overwinter either as an underground bulb or as a seed. And so we wanted to see if these three adaptations were things that the ancestors of modern-day flowering plants had before they moved into cold freezing zones or after the fact. That's really one of the things we wanted to do, was both to assess how important these adaptations are and their ordering through time.
So what did you find out?
So the key things we found out were that all three of those adaptations were really important, and that the interesting thing was deciduousness actually evolved after the fact. So after these early plants migrated northward and started to be exposed to freezing, they started to drop their leaves, and that became a hardwired genetic signal.
So the stress of the cold is what set that one off.
That's right.
Okay.
However, with respect to the two other adaptations, so the size of the chambers, plants that tended to have smaller vessels and plants that tended to be herbaceous, or clades that tended to be herbaceous, were more likely to move into the temperate zone than others. So those adaptations actually evolved in the tropics before moving into the temperate zone.
So that's why we don't have plants like palm trees in Logan, Utah, and other tropical plants?
Yeah, so some of these tropical plants that you're maybe thinking of, within their family, or their clade is how we refer to it, there was probably very little likelihood of having an herbaceous adaptation or having small vascular systems. Because of that, it was very difficult we basically had a very low probability that these clades would evolve those traits and then move into the temperate zone, because it was just the climate was too severe for them.
So some of them have had longer to adapt, and so that's why it happened before the cold hit. The cold starts hitting, and those plants that were able, that already had that adaptation,
yes,
able to survive.
With respect to the herbaceousness and the vascular system, that definitely appears to be true based on our analysis.
Okay. And what about those plants that just went underground? Is that also adaptation to the cold?
It absolutely is. We weren't able to investigate. I think it'd be really interesting to look at the size of the tuber or the bulb and see how that played a role. This was a really large-scale analysis of plants. So we had about 30,000 species in our analysis, which is unprecedented for this kind of study. And so we were a bit limited on the kinds of traits that we had consistently across all of that plant diversity. But bulbs, I think, and the presence of the bulbs and how large they are and the different kinds of adaptations that they might have would be another really interesting way to kind of dig into this herbaceous adaptation and try to parse it apart a little bit more.
Does having the ability to reproduce via flowers have an advantage over those that don't, other than just being able to be into the colder climate?
Yeah, so I would say actually having flowers itself doesn't necessarily pre-adapt you to being able to tolerate colder climates. In fact, our non-flowering plants, our conifers, are very well adapted to freezing. I mean, look at the mountainside outside here in Utah. It's mostly, especially when you go up in elevation, it's mostly conifers. I should just mention conifers have specially adapted vascular systems that are extremely narrow and very resistant to drought and freezing. That being said, flowers are really critical for organisms because they allow what we refer to as outcrossing. So they allow plants to basically ensure their genetic material goes from their individual to another individual, and therefore they're not inbreeding with themselves. What this allows, and also the fact that there's a pollinator intimately linked to the transfer of this pollen, is really important because that pollinator will ensure that that pollen is carried further away in space, ensuring that there's less relatedness to the individuals that pollen eventually ends up with. All of this does, it's just like with humans. If you were to breed with someone in your family, that wouldn't be very advantageous for your offspring. However, if you breed, you have this hybrid vigor, if you breed with someone from a different culture, you're going to have much more likely to have genetic resistance for various diseases. Potentially, the dominant alleles that are really helpful become expressed in that population. So you're getting greater diversity and you're avoiding inbreeding deficiencies. And so that's some of the things that flowering really allowed these plants to evolve much more rapidly in adaptation to stresses and to show much greater diversity across ecosystems.
Well, let's talk about the project then. There was this need to know, why did the plants do this? How did it get started? Because there were 50 people working on this project, and as we were talking before the program, it started out with a grant among a few, and then how did you become involved with it?
Yeah, so this was a really exciting project for me to participate in because this isn't necessarily my primary research. It was really kind of a side project. But it was through the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, which is an NSF-funded center in Durham, North Carolina. And this was an example of what we refer to as a working group in science. So a working group is just a collection of scientists. In this case, we had, I think, 23 co-authors on the paper. And we accumulated at different times. And we all came together to try to address the tempo and mode of plant evolution. We were really interested in that as a kind of guiding theme. And so to address that theme, we started accumulating really large databases. And this project is kind of, its contribution is providing three key databases to the scientific community. One is the largest phylogenetic tree or time tree, which is a map of relatedness amongst plants. So we created the largest time tree We also created really large databases of plant traits, so things like the herbaceousness or woodiness and the vascular systems, as well as many other adaptations that we have data on. And then lastly, the last database we created was the climate and distribution data, and that's what I contributed to the project. So my contribution was really trying to understand where this really broad array of species occurred on the Earth. And to do that, I processed about 47 million records.
So how will this be used? I mean, we talked before the program about this tree and how you said it's still incomplete.
That's right.
How open is it? Can other scientists and researchers add their knowledge into it?
Absolutely. So I should say first, the tree was built from data on GenBank. So this is a repository of all scientists are contributing their genetic data to this. So without that open data, we could have never created this tree. So we used that data from GenBank as well as what we'll refer to as a backbone, so a really good hypothesis as to what the early relationships between plants were. And then we posted on top of that backbone this new information provided to us by GenBank. And that created this really large map of relatedness amongst the plants. We have that this tree is completely open and available to anyone that's interested. It's posted with our paper as a supplemental material. And I should emphasize, it is incomplete. It only has 30,000 taxa. Flowering plants are much more diverse than that. However, it is very broad in its diversity. And one thing that we can, that is useful, the tree is still very useful even though it's incomplete, because close relatives tend to be very similar in plant life. And so even though we might not have all the species, we have sampled the plant diversity quite broadly, and so we can still say quite a bit about the total extent of adaptations and the placement of those adaptations on the tree.
So you may not have an onion in there, but maybe you have something else in the Allium family?
That's right, exactly. Okay. Yeah, most likely we do have onion.
Well, if you have any questions or comments, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Daniel McGlynn is a USU ecologist, and we're talking about a paper that was recently published in the journal Nature about how plants have adapted to the cold. So I'm thinking also the opposite direction with global warming and so forth, as the planet cycles back into a warmer climate. So what are these plants going to do going back the other way? I mean, it hasn't happened yet, so we don't know for sure, but why don't you give me your best guess?
You know, that's a great question and something our group has been thinking about. We might try to tackle with some future papers. So, one of the adaptations that we looked at in this current paper was, as I mentioned, the size of the vascular system. And I also mentioned that that's important both with respect to freezing and drought. And so with global climate change, one of the things we're really expecting, in addition to this slow warming, is rapid increases in variance in climate. So more likely to have droughts, more likely to have floods. And these swings, and really rapid swings in drought stress, could have a big negative impact on plants that have larger vessel systems, basically. Those large vessel systems are great when water is very abundant. You know, you can be really efficient and very competitive for resources. However, if you get knocked back by those drought stress, that could have a really be very detrimental for a lot of plant diversity. And so that's one of the things that we can start to look at, is not only which of those clades or which families of plants are more likely to be potentially susceptible to drought stress, but also where they occur on the earth. And so that's definitely a future project that I think our group might dig into.
I'm just thinking about my vegetable garden and how a zucchini or a squash plant just has a huge vascular system and a little bit of stress or a little bit of cold, just gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's just gone, but it's been able to continue because of seed. You know, but it's not one that goes below ground. It's just an annual. So anyway, a lot of great questions, a lot of great answers. I look forward to the project continuing. So there'll be some other published papers.
Yeah, we have a paper coming out February 5th that looks at the basically what we refer to as shifts happen. And so we were looking at all the major evolutionary shifts in plant diversity across 7 or 8 different key traits, and that'll be in the Journal of Ecology. So,
now I have one last question for you.
Sure.
How do you get this specialized?
Well, I guess, you know, I was always really interested in plants and natural ecosystems since I was a kid. However, it wasn't until I was really in college that I started to realize that there was this whole discipline of ecology and that there's rules that we can kind of decipher about how ecosystems work. That really fascinated me. And I started doing undergraduate research. That's a great way to kind of get your foot wet and to see, hey, is this something that could work for me? I loved it. And so I went on and got my PhD, and it kind of the rest is just kind of leading me down this path.
Well, we're grateful to have you here at Utah State University, and thanks for coming
in. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You bet. You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Daniel McGlynn, USU ecologist, has been talking about a recently published paper in the journal Nature about how plants have adapted to the cold. Basically, the plant getting the plant's winter parka is how I saw it mentioned in an article. And I'm sure we'll have more information as more articles get published. And you've been listening to Access with to Zesty Garden. We'll be coming up in the second half of the program and talking with Shane Taylor of Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake. So stay tuned.